This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is a podcast edition of Technogaze on Joy 94.9. In Melbourne, you can tune in on Monday night, 7 p.m. on 94.9 FM or online at joy.org.au/listen live. For more information, visit joy.org.au.
Plug it in, turn it on, with Technogaze on Joy 94.9.
Sponsored by Right Click IT. The right information and right solutions for your business.
RightClickIT.com.au.
Joy 94.9. Radio chic.
Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip and zip it, lock it, fill it, call it, find it, view it, code it, jump and lock it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop for man.
Good evening, welcome to Technogaze on Joy 94.9, the show where we look into the past, observe the current, and gaze into the future of technology. My name is Mark Pownie, and with me in the studio is Brennan Law. Hello,
hey.
Brennan.
How's it going?
Also with us in the studio is Dave Glover. Hello, Dave.
Yeah, hi there.
How are you going?
Very good.
Tonight, as always, we'll bring you up to date with some of the latest technology news. And as you may know, Microsoft's latest operating system, Windows 7, is on its way to our computer hard drives. Later in the show, we will bring you an in-depth analysis of the upcoming release, what has prompted the new developments in Windows 7, and where to from here after Windows 7. We will bring this to you from a unique perspective. Dave, you're a developer evangelist for Microsoft, isn't that right?
That's right, spot on.
And, of course, Brendan, I guess you could say you're a Microsoft enthusiast slash fanboy.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't go so far as fanboy, but I'm definitely the, like I said to you, the yin to your Apple yang.
You took the words right out of my mouth, my Apple yang.
And
that's
right.
That is the last time we're going to mention Apple for the
show. I mean, oh, that's a shame.
I'll believe it when I hear it, dude.
Excellent. So you have been told, as a listener at home, I'm not allowed to talk Apple anymore tonight, except maybe at the very end when we talk about future.
Wait, what's this maybe?
Well, anyway, as promised, let's start off with some news.
Alrighty. Okay, well, I'm a bit of a fan of a site called techradar.com. And I picked up a couple of articles off there. And the one that I spotted of recent, which was some new interesting news really from the Intel's developer forum, which happened in San Francisco last week.
Wow.
And basically the Intel CEO showed off some new wafer technology, which is built on their new 22-nanometer process technology. So things are getting pretty damn small.
Right. So these are the CPUs inside our computers, the things that do all the processing,
spot on. So, I mean, this technology can be used for CPUs and memory. So, to give you an example, what they showed off, they had a new wafer, which was fingernail size, and it contained something like 2.9 billion transistors, and was configured up as a 364 million bits of what's called SRAM. So, this is not to be confused with SDRAM. But it's a new type of memory called static random access memory. It's faster and uses a lot less power. So that's kind of good news all around.
So this is part of the processor, or is it a replacement for your typical memory that you have in your computer?
Well, I think the idea is in the future, static RAM will probably become the predominant kind of memory that will be inside a system.
Right.
Mostly because it doesn't take as much power to keep it active. With dynamic RAM today, you need to basically refresh the power the whole time.
Yeah, I would assume that with static RAM, it's static because it doesn't require power to keep whether it's a 0 or 1 or not.
Yeah, I don't think it's completely power-free. I think there has to be a refresh, but the whole kind of...
Less refreshes, maybe.
Less refreshing, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Right.
So the other thing that they also announced is something called, what they discussed was also something called Sandy Bridge. And Sandy Bridge is a new 32 nanometer microprocessor technology. And the really interesting thing about this one was it's actually one die and actually contains both the integrated graphics chip plus the CPU all in one die. Ah. So that's kind of getting kind of interesting.
It reminds me a little bit of the, was it NVIDIA Tegra chip that they announced for mobile devices, where it also has graphics and processor kind of linked together on the same chip, but that was more for mobility and for power usage,
right,
as well.
Yes, in fact, that was kind of talked about at the conference too. And finally, the last bit was kind of interesting, which is really around what they're doing around linking devices. And they've announced something called, it's called Light Peak. And it is capable, it's basically an optical cable, which is capable of transferring 10 gigabits of data per second. And to give you an idea what that means is that you could transfer the contents of a Blu-ray movie, for example, onto another device in 30 seconds.
30 seconds, wow.
Yeah, so that's pretty damn fast.
I need to be able to copy my Blu-ray DVDs that quickly.
Especially I need fly-by-nighter DVD Blu-ray person. Yeah. Great.
So that was interesting news out of the Intel Developers Forum. I'm sure there's lots more, but those are the kind of bits I picked up on.
Excellent, thank you. So this one's a quick one, but important nonetheless. It was brought to my attention by our friends over at samesame.com.au. It has come to light that the net over in Iraq has a certain sinister component to it for us gay men and women. The report, which originated in the UK's Guardian newspaper, talks of computer science graduates being recruited to trawl gay internet's chat sites for up to 6 hours a day. They identify the gay men and women, and on the chat sites track them down and, in fact, kidnap them. Once kidnapped, they... And this is a quote from one of the graduates who was interviewed. They make sure they know why they were being held and give them the chance to ask God's forgiveness before they are killed. So that's a bit of a sort of a downer on things.
Certainly,
but
is, yeah.
It has been said that ever since the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, that violence and oppression against gay and lesbian Iraqis has increased due to the comparatively lacking amount of asserted power. The power vacuum has led to so-called religious militia, who carry out activities of persecution towards numerous minorities, including gays and lesbians. Now, I've always assumed vigilance is key to maintaining safe online activities here in Australia. Perhaps being extra observant of someone's chat room replies to really judge whether they are who they say they are, I guess. But I guess in Iraq, the stakes are higher. This is about gays and lesbians being killed.
I guess the thing is, going back to the being vigilant about who you're talking to as well, I mean, a lot of these gay men wouldn't have had a lot of contact with other gay men either. And you know, they'd be kind of inexperienced on the internet.
Much more vulnerable, I would have thought.
Absolutely. And then people who are doing this sort of thing would become more and more predator-like and become practiced in the way that they do it. It's a horrible thing. It really is absolutely bad.
This is Techno Gaze on Joy 94.9. We're just discussing the latest in tech news this week.
Yeah, I've got a really cool one.
Right.
So, Swedish scientists have recently developed a paper-thin, eco-friendly battery.
So, what's that? Paper-thin. Right. Oh, okay.
It's not paper-based. It's actually been made out of polymers.
That's right, because I saw the headline fly on past my RSS reader, and I thought, paper, what? Hang on, batteries aren't made of paper.
No, it's just paper thin. Well, it's based on like nanotechnology, so it's got layers of stuff and bits and good stuff. And one day it'll be used to power some really cool things. Like you could imagine like a flexible sort of like electronic rechargeable newspaper that just, you know, updates daily, or, you know, you take on the tram on the way to work, or maybe like a t-shirt that has like a changeable photo frame on it. So when you're you know, sick of your current colour, you change it and it you know, has a picture of your mum on it when you're going to visit mum or something.
Oh, yes.
So as I understand it, it's also based off green algae. I think this is where some of the actual kind of main substrate for it is algae-based. So it's right. Kind of pretty eco-friendly too, by the sounds of things.
Algae is getting a bit of an outing at the moment, isn't it? It's a cure for all of our woes. I mean, it's, you know...
It's kind of goopy.
No more... That's true.
Goopy.
Apparently, the batteries charge faster than conventional batteries as well. And, it'd be great for things like packaging and clothing and that sort of application.
Indeed it will. Now, I thought we'd go back to a previous news item that we've spoken about before. Some weeks ago, Technogaze reported that France's so-called three strikes laws, the laws that enabled the record industry to cut your internet connection simply by accusing you of illegal file sharing, were struck from France legislation due to them being ruled unconstitutional. Well, the laws and all their chilling effects are back. The French National Assembly, two Tuesdays ago, passed the law, this time with an amendment that ensures all disconnection notices must be served only after a judge has ordered the act to occur. So to give you the full backstory, essentially the laws allow for agents working on behalf of the record industry to obtain information that suggests you might be illegally transferring files on peer-to-peer networks. Once the information is obtained, you may be sent an email notifying you of the accusations. However, the email doesn't need to contain any reference to the object which was considered illegal, nor does it need to state which corporate entity is making the accusation. If a repeat offence is suspected within the following 6 months by either the record industry agents, your ISP, or government authorities, a second notice is sent to you via registered mail. So upon the third suspected offence, your ISP will be required to suspend your internet connection for a period between 2 months and 1 year. Your name is then entered on a blacklist, and other ISPs are also prevented from providing you with internet access for the disconnection period. So that was the original law, and effectively the law and its associated entities are known as HADOPI in France, which is an acronym for a bunch of words that I'm not even going to...
Oh, French words. Give them a go.
No, I really can't.
Can I see?
I don't have them written down.
Oh, go on.
Yes, anyway. If only we had Paul Miguel here tonight, he'd be able to help us out
give
with
it a
his
go.
French accent.
pass it through Babelfish or something.
Hello, Paul, if you're listening. So to placate the concerns of its opponents in its original form, this time the laws were passed with an included provision for judges to be involved when the disconnection notice is ordered. However, most of the same opponents this time around have continued to criticise the laws, stating that the process does not constitute fair access to the legal system. Specifically, the accused party is not present when the order is given, nor are they given the opportunity to argue against it in front of the judge.
So this is kind of the same sort of thing that we've been finding all over the world at the moment.
Yeah, well, France seems to be a bit of a, what should I say, a market leader in that sense, because they seem to be really pushing for this this particular law to go through, and there's obviously impetus there to want to bring it about. Interestingly, this version of the law has also included a provision that states all internet users must keep their connections secure and are responsible for what happens to them. So they've really thought through this before that they make it into legislation, and have actually, you know, ensured that we are all accountable for our own connections.
So basically, if little Johnny's at home or somewhere like playing around with the computer and starts torrenting and stuff, then who's responsible?
Well, I guess you as a parent, perhaps.
Well, go to the other thing. What about shared internet connections? What about like a library or something? Who's responsible there?
One, that's actually a really good point, because particularly with government provided internet access, I mean, is there? I guess they could say that there are safeguards to stop those internet connections from being used. You know, the software that's loaded onto those PCs aren't necessarily...
Well, there's a way around everything. Unplug it from the computer, plug it into your laptop. Where you go.
Indeed. Yes, that's true. Any more news?
Well, I have one more remaining one. It's kind of not technological, though.
I peeked over your shoulder before, and I guess it kind of...
Okay, some people may know. This has been going around Twitter today. That's why it's kind of funny. A three-month-long competition to name Kraft's new version of Vegemite has just concluded. The new version includes to combine the original recipe with cream cheese, and a web developer, who's 27 years old, has come up with the name iSnack 2.0.
Really?
iSnack 2.0.
Did he work for Apple by any chance?
No, but I just have to say this, right? Anybody who puts I in front of a word and thinks they're cool really isn't, okay? Apple is not cool, and putting I in front of a word is not cool either.
I think what's worse about it as well is the 2.0 at the end.
Like, well, it's kind of Web 2.0.
It's all very connected, isn't it?
It's the next version of Vegemite.
This is food stuff. It's not...
I know.
It's not on the online
at
all.
It is ridiculous.
It does not qualify as an online.
I think it kind of indicates to like, and this is mainstream society here, okay? Mm. And taking on like a kind of a technological name. I think it's kind of like coming of age of technology. I mean, it used to be really geeky, but now lots of people are getting into it. It's a cool thing now.
But actually, what was kind of curious is you talked about how the first name came up. How we got the original Vegemite. Actually, so that's kind of, it is kind of related to its new name.
Yeah, well, the original version of Vegemite was actually chosen from consumer suggestions back in 1923. So there you go.
Right. So they did the same process again, just...
It sounds like it. Well, I mean, I don't think it was a competition originally. It was more of a send in your suggestions in with the chose one.
Right.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Might be the best thing since sliced bread.
Oh,
she's sorry.
There's got to be a 2.0 version of that one as well. Anyway, we won't go there. Next up, we'll be talking about Microsoft's next operating system release, Windows 7. We'll talk about where some of the features have stemmed from, taking hopefully just the best from Windows Vista, and also some of the features that may in fact be game changers in themselves. You're listening to TechnoGaze on Joy 94.9.
Plug it in, turn it on, with TechnoGaze on Joy 94.9.
Sponsored by RightClick IT. The right information and right solutions for your business.
RightClickIT.com.au.
You're listening to TechnoGaze on Joy 94.9. And tonight we're discussing the imminent release of Windows 7, the new operating system from Microsoft. Now, when you turn on your computer, you probably notice when it boots up the big Microsoft Windows logo. Well, the new release of Windows is set to make some really tangible improvements to the way you use your computer. Now, the operating system, of course, is the thing that defines how you start the programs you use and how it interacts with the various devices you have plugged into your computer, both inside and outside. And Dave, now, you're from Microsoft, aren't you?
Mm-hmm, spot on.
Excellent. Yep. And now we have this mind map diagram in front of us, which you graciously put together for us. This is, mind map is an application you can use to sort of bring about a cloud type tag cloud. Excuse me, not cloud tag. What is it? So I guess we should probably pick one off the cloud tag. What about key drivers? Where does this come from? Why is Windows 7? What's brought it about? Why?
Okay, well, I mean, there's a whole stack of things, and you've got to appreciate that when the product groups start planning these things, they start, you know, years in advance. So they're already planning the next version of Windows 7 when, you know, when XP was around, when Windows Vista was around. So it's a whole stack of things coming out there. So I kind of read it off a few things that I thought were kind of key drivers. Mm. And in some respects, and we were laughing over the break, that Mark seems to be incapable of actually not mentioning the word Apple.
But I was railroaded into that discussion, I have to say. Someone mentioned I something, and I just thought Apple.
Yeah, that may have been me. Sorry about that.
So one of the key drivers around, and really around the whole Windows 7, it was really around the user experience. And in fairness, I think Apple have done a hang of a lot around, you know, be it iPhone or the Apple, and redriving that. And I think the whole industry has really set up and just looked at what's going on. So for me, that was kind of like a really key driver. And the product groups really sat back and thought about common user scenarios. What could they just do to make their environment look fresher, more consistent, simpler, all those types of good things.
So you've got new form factors on there as one of the items. And one of the things I noticed there was multi-touch. So I guess it's one of the things that Apple have brought about.
Apple.
But is that something that's coming in Windows 7? Is that something that is supported as part of Windows 7? To say.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a history to this. Some people know this thing called a Microsoft Surface, which is a kind of like a tabletop device, and their whole idea behind that was to look at different kind of interaction models for users, so they could literally sit at a table and they could start interacting with the objects on the table in a much more natural way.
Yeah, I've had the privilege of actually going to the Microsoft Microsoft to actually let me into their office.
They let you in. Yeah,
they do. And there was a Surface sitting there for quite a while, and we had the pleasure of trying to use it. It let me you know, put your phone down on the surface, and it sort of could interact with that. And
you, very cool.
It also had that multi-touch feature about it as well, where you could use both hands, in fact, to move things around on the screen and sort of...
You could do the Apple-type pinching type thing. And
yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
I guess it had a bit more to it as well. Like, you could actually flip things around. So, for example, you might have a photo on the Surface device, and you could actually, with your fingers, you know, on the other side of the photo, you could actually turn it around as if it was a real photo, which is quite nifty.
Do you know, with the Surface device, does it require the cameras above to kind of look at, down at what you're doing? Or?
Well, actually, they've got cameras underneath. And that's probably the biggest difference between a Surface and the kind of multi-touch and Surface, which is much more about being able to recognize objects that are hovering around the surface.
Right.
So with Windows 7 and, you know, various devices like iPhones and things like that, you actually have to touch the screen.
Yep.
So with a Surface, you have a number of cameras, which you could kind of figure out, there's a device or there's a hand. You could recognize hands or fingers, or you could program it to recognize a glass or a phone or things like that.
So this is built into Windows 7 as well, this multi-touch functionality. Is it sort of built into the underlying operating system? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, so the biggest difference between the Surface Touch technology and the touch technology that we'll put into Windows 7 is that Windows 7 has all the stuff around kind of gesture support, being able to interact with photos and things like that in a very natural way, but it doesn't have the concept of being able to interact with objects. It'll hover above the screen, for example. So it's a touch screen type of multi-touch technology. Right. So that it's a bit different, but I guess the main thing about it is it's kind of making it, putting into the multi-touch into the hands of millions of users who'll be using Windows 7. So that changes the way, so lots of applications coming out there for multi-touch and things like that.
Now, one of the other little mind map tags here is evolving hardware architecture. So you've got some big numbers there for CPUs. How many CPUs it can handle and how many cores it can handle is an important thing for Windows 7, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. So if you think back in, I guess, back in the late 90s, or in fact early 90s, what am I saying? There's a chap called Dave Cutler who was kind of one of the main architects, or was the main architect for Windows NT, and he actually came out of Digital, and he was kind of like one of these guys that specialized in all this stuff. Mm. And when they were designing Windows NT, they kind of thought, well, maybe we'd have two processors in a box, maybe four processors. And if you think about that now, man, you can go off and buy a quad-core CPU for a couple of $100 nowadays. So the whole kind of philosophy behind what was considered to be a scalable system has really changed.
Right.
And certainly with Windows XP and Windows Vista, the kind of the design goals are really around four to eight kind of processors. But technically, you could scale up to 64 CPUs. But what's really gone on with Windows 7, and bear in mind the Windows 7 kernel also finds its way into Windows Server R2.
That's what I was going to say, yeah. So the core thing would be more in terms of the server architecture. Like Vista was associated with kind of Windows Server 2008. Not R2, whereas Windows 7 has the same architecture as Server 2008 R2, which would be where this comes into play.
Yeah, so exactly. So most of us aren't going to have machines with 256 cores. Well, maybe
why not?
No,
I would like that. Apart from the amount of heat it would generate.
That's all right. We just have really good cooling systems in our homes.
And then a huge power bill.
But you'll have a really good SETI at home result.
That's right. You encode stuff really quickly.
But you're right. A lot of these kind of scalability things are really going to be playing into the server environment as well. So that's so there's a whole lot of work just being done around scaling systems and applications into these really vast numbers.
Because that's an important point, isn't it? That Microsoft typically look at their server operating system and their client operating system or workstation operating system, and it's kind of a parallel path that they go down now, where it used to be that Windows 95, for example, was quite different from Windows NT. Whereas nowadays, they're trying to align them both together, and when you see a new workstation release, such as Windows 7, there's also an accompanying server release, which is a type of, for those at home who might work in a computer-based environment, the server is a thing that you might get your files from, or that serves out a website or an intranet site or whatever. So there's those two types of systems that Microsoft are catering for, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a really interesting project. If you go into something called channel9.msdn.com and dig around, you'll find a project called WinMain. And WinMain was basically an effort to really kind of look at the kernel and try and isolate it and make it much more testable.
Right.
And so the whole objective behind this was to come up with a kernel which would run out at Windows 7 or run out in the server, which was really, really highly tested. Mm. And then that would form a common platform for the new operating system. So that was a lot of goal. And you can imagine just the test matrices and things mm-hmm. like that mm. simplified a lot by having a common kernel across those two platforms.
All right. The other thing that I'll pick up off this mind map in front of me is compatibility. So you've got a thing called there's XP mode, isn't there? I've heard about this, didn't I?
This is really cool, actually. Yeah. So with the, I think it's just the ultimate version.
I think it's professional and above.
Professional and above. Yeah, you can actually download a VHD, a prepackaged Windows XP VHD to run on your Windows 7 machine. So it's really great if you've got a modern laptop, you've installed Windows 7 64-bit, and you might have an application which doesn't run on 64-bit, such as the Cisco VPN client, which I found out. It's so annoying. Anyway, so you can fire up your Windows XP virtual machine, run whatever you like in there. In fact, you can even have the programs come out and sit on your taskbar, so you can run them directly from Windows 7, but they're actually running in Windows XP.
So do they actually look like they're sort of running in their own virtualized environment? I mean, I know...
Well, you can tell the difference because the Windows 7 applications have a nice glassy interface around the outside, whereas the XP ones have the kind of standard XP blue one.
Of course, which is the difference between Aero and
the XP
whatever the...
What was that called?
Windowing
Bliss.
System.
It's called Bliss.
Bliss. Yeah. That's Bliss. For us.
Hey, look, I'm not going to lose my accent, right?
Yeah, but yeah, absolutely right. The other key thing about that with Windows 7 Professional and above, you get a license for XP. So when you're downloading,
right?
So you actually have the license. So it's a fully licensed version. But the main reason we're putting it there is really around compatibility. And I guess the main thing to bear in mind as well, if you've got an application which runs quite happily today on Windows Vista, it's highly likely that it's going to run on Windows 7.
Yeah, because I think the main problem was kind of the driver, the display driver compatibility between Windows 7 and, I mean, between Vista and XP. That was kind of the main reason that programs didn't work quite so well.
Yeah, there was changes in program models and memory models and things like that, which kind of broke older apps. You know, some of these apps just, you know, the software developers disappeared nowadays, and you know, you're stuck with running that version.
Yeah, absolutely. But the one thing that really excites me about Windows 7 is less user account control prompts. So, you know, the one thing that annoyed me the most, and which I always turned off in Windows Vista, was the, are you really sure you want to do this? Give this program permission, click that four times, you know, and jump around through this firing hoop.
We got a lot of feedback on that, funny enough.
I can imagine, yes.
And actually, what we've done with Windows 7, and I don't know why this wasn't done in Vista, but it wasn't anyway, but we actually now recognize if it's a system component and it's been signed by Microsoft and it was part of the operating system, and you're changing, like for example, you're adding in a new printer drive, which is already in the box, we're not going to prompt you. So what you'll find is that now it's called consent based, and you'll see it on the Apple Mac and various flavors of Linux as well. So it's pretty common kind of a approach to solving security. The main reason behind it is to make the end user really obvious that you're going to install something. So you're jumping around the web, and I think it was called the Dancing Pig or something. You know, click here to watch the Dancing Pig was a well known virus out on the internet, and it's to kind of stop that kind of scenario where the users just kind of automatically go and click on this. Yeah, I want to see the Dancing Pig. So it's just to make systems.
I know. I have friends like that are like, oh, why have I got so many viruses? You know, I just click OK, yes, OK, next, and just I get all these viruses all the time. I'm like, you're supposed to hit cancel, no, and close.
Yeah, but I mean, we got a lot of feedback on that, and even actually with Vista Service Pack 1, we really tamed it down a bit. So, but with Windows 7, it makes much more sense. So
absolutely. Cool. Yay.
This is TechnoGaze on Joy 94.9, and tonight we're discussing Windows 7, where it's come from and where it's headed. Now, you can contact us while we're on air.
You can. If you've got any questions about Windows 7, or if you've got anything you want to know about Windows at all, or you've got some Microsoft people here, you can contact us onair@joy.org.au. That's for email. You can SMS us on 0427JOY949, or we're also on Twitter if you come on TechnoGaze.
That's right. TechnoGaze, that's TechnoGaze.
That's right. Of course,
and just to cover all bases as well, if you don't have a numeric keypad with the letters in the right place on your phone, you can always SMS us 0427 569 949. That's what the Joy
handy for people with Blackberries anyway.
Indeed, yes. So what's what else is there about Windows 7? There's, I guess, there's a performance and hardware side of things, which Perhaps there's some lessons learnt in Windows Vista. The fact that it's sort of required more display hardware for in particular, but also the more general.
I did, but I think that's this is one of Microsoft's only releases where actually the hardware requirements are less than the previous version.
Mm.
So it run on things that like netbooks, like I've got in front of me. It's fantastic on a netbook. Yeah, there's actually no major architectural changes in terms of driver support. So any of your Vista drivers should actually work on Windows 7.
Right.
Yep. Which is fantastic.
And I've got a machine, which I have to confess was a bit clunky on Vista, and that was a 1 gig Pentium 4, and I banged Windows 7 onto that, and it just flies along.
Mm,
right. And it's all those kinds of things. I mean, and they really have sat back and thought about it. One of the kind of main design criteria was, let's only start what we need to start. So you'll find... when Windows 7 starts up, it just starts up a hang lot faster, and we don't start stuff that actually maybe you'll never use.
Right.
So you have this whole idea of what's called trigger start services. And I don't know, for example, maybe your IP address, for example, changes. And maybe if your IP address changes, then we'll trigger off a service and we'll start it up and then shut it down. So just lots smarter use of
cool.
memory resources.
It's actually really interesting. And that sort of leads to the feature I saw where if you try to connect to site, for example, in your intranet zone, you might not be at work though, but you still might want to connect to your intranet. It might also automatically open up a VPN connection to your network. Is that something that Trigger sort of picks up on? Or
ooh, I'm trying to think. Are you talking about direct access?
I think so. Yes, that was what it was called. Maybe am I confusing my server technologies with my workstation?
No. In Windows 7, for a lot of people dialing into work,
yes.
Most of us today kind of VPN, and you've got lots of scripts and stuff that runs on your machine to kind of VPN. With Windows 7, with Windows Server R2 on the back end, there is something called direct access, and you still obviously require certification, some sort of authentication. It's typically around some sort of smart card. And the idea being is you pretty much seamlessly connect into your corporate environments. You can get onto your SharePoint sites or your email sites or whatever, things like that. And it really kind of manages the transition between your corporate internet and if you're working from home and just the internet.
Right.
So it kind of makes it much sense.
So it kind of takes on that transparent, just does things for you that it should be doing.
Don't say it.
No. Hey, I didn't.
You almost said the three words that are not allowed.
Just because they're associated with that company that we shall not mention.
That's right. I'm glad you said that.
So what other performance and hardware requirements, sort of related things are there? I guess it's, we've got here runs happily on a 1 gig P4. That's what the machine that you mentioned before.
Yep.
What's this smart background?
Oh, what did I write there about smart background?
Okay,
what I think I meant to write... You can tell this is well rehearsed. Okay, what I'm pretty damn sure this was about is that one of the issues we had, for example, in Vista was around indexing or kind of background processes. They kind of start indexing, and then suddenly you couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
Or your system decided to go and scan for
Windows
a virus.
Windows Defender. Oh, my God.
Yeah, so I think that's what a lot of it was about. So what would happen? These services would kick off. Well, frankly, it didn't have to be something inside Windows. It could have been a third-party application sitting on there.
Mm.
And what we've introduced is what we call smart background I.O., input-output.
Yes.
And the whole idea behind this is you can give systems low level or low priority access to doing disk access, and it's obviously really great for doing things like search. So the system can happily figure out, I'm not doing too much at the moment, and we'll go and prioritize some searching or indexing or things like that. So that's kind of what that's about. So you just find that through the whole system is kind of much more tuned and much more kind of aware of what's going on, the user interactions, and when the system's not being used, hey, look, we'll go and do off.
Because that's one of the design focus of Windows 7, isn't it? It's all about the user more than anything else. It's taken on a lot of those design concepts that, usability first.
Absolutely. And really has. And I know we've talked about various upgrades on other platforms out there, and the thing is that the realistically Vista and things like that were a lot about some really fundamental architectural changes. But the thing about architectural changes is end users don't really give a stuff,
and they come with a lot of bugs as well.
Yeah, so and it can make the kind of transition to that new platform really really quite challenging. Whereas Windows 7, we kind of got past those architectural changes, and it's a lot more about kind of like the user engagement, and it's just kind of like fun. fun and it's fresh and it looks good and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, being able to personalize it.
I actually haven't met anybody who's used it and hasn't liked it yet. So that's got to say something really good about it. If you're clinging on to Windows XP right now, you should really be looking into Windows 7.
There are a lot of businesses out there waiting, you know, for Windows 7 to come
out. Absolutely, there are. Yeah.
With Windows XP being as solid as it is.
Mm. So there's been a lot of bad press about Vista, and I think a lot of people are kind of, even if they haven't used it, they're kind of like, oh, I've heard so many bad things about it. But what I've heard on, you know, through various people as well, is that kind of like each second operating system is kind of a good one with Microsoft, and I think this really rings true with this latest version of Windows.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to this point, is that you tend to find big architectural changes coming through which don't always kind of translate to something really tangible to the end user, but stuff that often needs to be done.
Hmm.
Right, so any other user experience type things that we want to mention, maybe? What about the new display technologies? There's flex displays that, you know, there's talk about people creating flexible devices that basically act like
with my
like
paper-thin battery technology.
Yes, well, maybe that
you can have that coated on the back. You're off and running.
Power it forever. Does Windows 7 have any of that sort of those kind of drivers? I mean, the underlying technology there is, does it bring about those type of technologies more? I mean,
it probably gets back to what we talked about before, which was around the multi-touch, And again, so we've got multi-touch, we've got gestures. So you can imagine having like a flexible display.
Mm.
And the idea, you can imagine like a newspaper, you want to be able to like gesture, you want to be able to turn the page, or those types of natural interactions. So the reality is, there are flexible displays, you know, people are prototyping them. But we're trying to put the technology into the platform that would then enable, you know, a developer to come along and build something really funky that would just kind of work on that.
So, having different methods of user interface, we're going to see a lot more. I think the mouse has had its time. It's had 30 years, and I think that it's on its way out. People are going to be using less of the mouse and less of the keyboard, and they're going to be using, you know, things that are around them and interacting with the computer in different ways, like facial recognition is going to be a lot more. I've seen some videos of eye tracking software, which kind of looks at what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And so you more naturally interact with your computer rather than actually having to use buttons and objects that you move around.
Mm.
So out of the box, you know, for the future, certainly, you know, but that's the way they're thinking about it. But, you know, today, when you go and buy a new machine, probably not. You're not going to see too much.
Well, I guess facial recognition is out there, but it's only...
It's not really becoming mainstream yet.
No,
I mean, there is that... I think we were talking about this last week, wasn't it? There is something called Live Cam from Microsoft. And if you've got a Live Cam camera, you can do some really funky things and just, you know, look at the camera and you can, you know, paint on glasses or a hat or, you know, just do more kind of fun kind of activities.
Right. And what other future things are there? There's, I guess the I've heard this before, pervasive computing. What is that all about? It's one of those cliched things that is used every now and then to try and say this is the future and we know what we're talking about type thing. But pervasive computing, is that something that we can look forward to, I guess, with...
I guess we should kind of explain what pervasive computing is. It's kind of also known as kind of follow me technology, where your life is kind of followed, or it follows you around wherever you are. So when you leave the office, they know that you're about to get in your car and go to the gym, and it gives you directions to the gym and then monitors your heart rate while you're running on the treadmill, and then it measures how many calories you've taken, so you can decide whether you want to go to McDonald's on the way home or to the salad bar, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Cool stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really sort of, I guess it's the type of thing that just helps you along your way instead of being in the way of doing what, you know, people work with computers today, but actually just helping you where
at the moment. You have to be pretty proactive to use a computer. You have to go to one, you have to, you know, log in or whatever, and you have to open up the application you want and use it. But, you know, in the future it's going to be a lot more kind of just passive and off to the side, and, you know, when you need to interact with it, you'll go and interact with it, but until then it's just going to be kind of sitting there.
Yeah, so a lot of it's about being connected as well. So devices that are connected, people talk about personal area networks and, you know, Bluetooth networks and all those types of things, or metropolitan networks or WANs or LANs, all those types of things. But the kind of key things behind that is that, you know, all these devices are connected, they're exchanging information, they're kind of looking at, you know, your overall patterns of, you know, kind of what you're doing, what you're up to.
Do Do you reckon clothing is going to have computing built in one
yep.
one day?
I mean, everything's going to have computing built in.
With your paper thin
well, paper thin batteries.
Yes, that's right.
I'm claiming them now. It wasn't Swedish scientists. It was actually me.
So, and fridges. This is an old chestnut, I guess.
Oh,
I
mean, we talked about that a few weeks ago. We had the bar thing that would actually mix your drinks
oh,
for
course,
you
yes,
and
yes.
order stuff off the net.
Pre-orders your mixes.
Yeah, so it was like a thing that sits under your cupboard. It's about the size of a dishwasher, and you program in your favourite drinks, and it would actually, you just push a button and it makes it for you. And then when it gets low on like Red Bull and Jagermeister, it'll actually go off and order some more. It's great.
It's not quite a fridge, though, is it? It's more of a bar fridge.
It's an internet device. But, you know, I mean, fridges, the line between internet device and all these sorts of things is going to blur.
Well, LG have done their internet fridge, or their fridge with a computer built
right.
in. But it, I don't know that it really has a particular, like a tangible purpose. I mean,
well, I think until things start getting like RFID tags and, you know, objects that are currently, you know, just dumb objects,
yeah,
will be able to be identified by devices around your home, which will mean that, you know, things can be tracked. You'll never lose your keys. Hopefully, you can call your wallet, sort of thing. And like, you know, when the milk's empty,
on silent.
Oh, you find your wallet's on silent. No. You know, when the milk's empty, it'll send out a special different sort of thing to the fridge, and the fridge will know that, you know, like you push a button on the fridge, it'll put you out a shopping list, or send your shopping list to your phone or to your flatmate's phone so he can go out and buy it.
Yeah, and the key to that, I guess, is RFID, and well, that's the next step, perhaps, to those kind of
yeah.
pervasive devices being available for you know, mass produced, because we're talking about, you know, the type of thing that the products that we're talking about are, you know, produced on billions, on the scale of billions
yeah.
a day type thing. So it needs to be cheap.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hardware that almost disposable, in fact.
Which is why my paper batteries will be really handy, because they're ecological friendly as well, because they can be easily disposed.
Yeah, well, they're not actually paper, though, are they? They were
no, they're algae meshed between nano robot tubes. Yeah.
So what? Moore's Law. Now, Moore's Law has been around for quite some time. It was a guy back in
I just read an article
Intel.
Today speaking about Moore's Law, sorry to interrupt.
No, right.
But they reckon Moore's Law is going to continue for another 10 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's been going for 30 years, it's going to keep going for another 10.
Because what is Moore's Law again? It's
number of transistors on a chip will double every 18 months.
Something like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's pretty much stayed true since the beginning. Does that mean that things have actually doubled in speed in that same time?
Well, I would say it's capability, because what you're seeing is that the CPUs today, they're obviously pushing the clock speed, so pushing that as hard as they can. But what you're seeing is that you're getting multi-core. So instead of just having one CPU, you're getting a core of multi-CPUs built into one die. And so you're going to see that kind of trend carrying on. And well, I guess one of the biggest challenges behind that is actually writing software, you know, writing the hardware in some respects is getting ahead, way ahead of software capabilities. So, yes, I think it's kind of more about capability and processor power, and then actually be able to spread that load across them.
Now, what, before we finish, did you really want to say something about Apple and Snow Leopard?
No, I've had my fill of Apple tonight. Thank you very much.
So have we.
This has been Technogaze for another week. I hope you've enjoyed our discussion. If you missed any part of the show and would like to listen to it again, you can go to our podcast, which is available at joy.org.au/technogaze. That's TECHNOGAZE. And while we're on all things Web 2.0, you can, of course, subscribe to our Twitter feed, which is on twitter.com/technogaze. Thank you, Dave, for joining us tonight.
That's a pleasure.
And thank you, Brendan. As always, it's a pleasure.
No problems.
Coming up, we go from geek to jock with the Sports Lounge hosted by Brendan and Tanya. That's another Brendan, not yourself, of course.
No, not that sporty.
So do stay tuned for that, and good night.
Plug it in, turn it on, with Technogaze on Joy 94.9.
Sponsored by RightClick IT, the right information and right solutions for your business.
RightClickIT.com.au.
This is a podcast edition of Technogaze on Joy 94.9. In Melbourne, you can tune in on Monday night, 7 p.m. on 94.9 FM or online at joy.org.au/listen live. For more information, visit joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.